Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Ready? One, two, three, four!
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about, you guessed it, the Iditarod, a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio in Nome. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we jump into today's episode, here's a word from our sponsor.
Support for Iditapod 2018 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
Alaska Public Media and KNOM are again teaming up to bring you coverage of the last great race. This is our third podcast of the season so far, but we're switching over to daily episodes the day of the race start. That is this Saturday, March 3rd, and that's when we switch over to having a new episode every morning with the latest news from the Iditarod Trail. Today in the studio, I'm joined by one of our trail reporters from last year, Ben Matheson. Hi, Ben.
Hey, guys.
And we also have, because he has not flown away yet, Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes.
Hello, and boy, will my arms be tired.
So today we want to talk about two of the toughest races so far this mushing season and what to expect maybe from the Iditarod this year. Ben, you covered the K300. What was it like this year?
This year was, as it always is with the K300, a really strange year. The river hadn't frozen up like it usually does. There was warm weather and so many holes on the Kuskokwim River that they couldn't actually run the trail on the river. They traditionally run from Bethel up to Aniak. That's about 150 miles. And then they turn around and go back down to Bethel, but they had to reroute the course because it was simply too hazardous to go on the river. So they developed this new trail that goes overland to Bogus Creek and then back to Bethel and then one more lap of that. So it was this completely different race trail on completely different conditions.
And Ben, even though it had been a really warm season, correct me if I'm wrong, but the race itself saw really cold temperatures just for the first time all winter.
Just in time, a cold front came through. So mushers faced, you know, wind chills reaching 40 degrees below zero and ambient temperatures down to, you know, 25 or 30 below. So extremely cold temperatures on a race on a trail that featured really rough glare ice. It set things up to be just extremely brutal for mushers and for dogs.
And despite all that, the difference from years past, we had a repeat champion again this year.
For the fourth year in a row, Pete Kaiser. Pete is a musher from Bethel, about 30 years old, and he has absolutely taken this race as his own. And he's trained, you know, his entire life on the river. He typically goes off and tries to find snow. He travels to interior Alaska and trains on the snow. But he spent the season training out in Bethel on the river. And in this race, that really comes down to how precise a musher can drive his team to this sort of knife's edge of performance while also maintaining the team's ability to run. There's only 10 hours of rest, 10 hours over 300 miles. He's really figured out exactly how to do that with his team, and he held off Jeff King, who's won this race 9 times, but also Norwegian Jor Olsen, who brought in second place this year.
And there were some notable scratches in that race, right?
On Saturday, as the race came back to Bethel, we saw Brent Sass make the decision to scratch with his team. He's in a rebuilding year, and he was simply just defeated by the trail. He told us that his dogs were not having a good time, that he wanted to give them a good experience, and that, like it is in all scratching situations, it's the best decision to scratch for the benefit of his dogs. We also had scratches from a really tough group of mushers. Aaron Burmeister from Nome, Jesse Holmes, Sim Smith, a bunch of really veteran mushers who came back to Bethel on that second day and just decided it wasn't right to try one more loop.
So a really tough mid-distance race. It starts out of Bethel, like you said. You have to fly everything there for the folks that aren't Pete Kaiser and some of the others that are from the area. Why do so many Iditarod mushers go out to compete in the Cusco 300?
For one, the Kuskokwim 300 has the biggest purse in sled dog racing outside of the Iditarod. So mushers, if they perform well, they can bring home a pretty significant paycheck. Pete Kaiser brings home $25,000 for his victory. It is sort of uniquely timed so that in mid-January, mushers can race among the best in the sport and really get a sense of how their team does. The Kuskokwim also offers a set of challenges that you're not going to get on a really nice, cold, snowy interior race. You get wide open river spaces, you get overflow, you get confusing trails sometimes. You get this real diversity of race conditions. But like I say, there's only 10 hours of rest, and it's absolutely one of the toughest races in all of dog mushing.
And Ben, there's a lot of attention on the 300-mile race, but there are sprints and smaller races too. I mean, what does the event as a whole bring to Bethel and some of the surrounding communities?
The Kuskokwim 300 really drives the local dog mushing economy and industry, and there's a whole suite of races all throughout the year associated with the Kuskokwim 300. During the weekend, there's a 150-mile race that brings in a lot of competitors. There's a shorter 75-mile race, which had to be postponed this year. That was the Akiak Dash. And there's basketball tournaments. There's concerts. It's the biggest event. I tell people, it's like Iditarod, except that it's done in a weekend.
So we have the Kuskokwim 300. There's also the Copper Basin 300, the Knick 200, the Willow 300, all of these mid-distance races that lead up to the Yukon Quest and the Iditarod. What is the importance of these mid-distance races as you kind of transition into longer distances?
Well, at one level, they're the qualifiers for the Iditarod. I think it's 750 miles in races that has to be completed by mushers that are hoping to qualify for the Iditarod. They're also a preview of who's looking good, who's running fast. This year, Nick Petit, who is no stranger to kind of the top placement in the Iditarod, won a number of races. I know a lot of people are looking at him and his team as they assess who's competitive this year in the Iditarod. I would add Wade Mars to that list of people that have just done really well on some of these mid-distance South Central races.
You don't get to see every single musher in these early races. Some, like Jeff King, always goes out to Bethel for the K300, and the Boozers used to do that. But you really don't get the full race picture. You get these little snapshots that may show who's hot and who's got definitely a really good team. But there's no perfect pre-race that tells you too much about the Iditarod.
And I mentioned the Yukon Quest. That one is near and dear to my heart, being from Fairbanks. I remember being a little kid at the start up on somebody's shoulders watching those teams go out.
Hopefully a parent's, but, you know, who knows?
I don't know who it was.
Somebody's.
It was somebody tall enough that I could see what was going on, and that was what was important. This year, we had the 35th running of the Quest, and I actually talked to reporter Zoe Rome about the race and why it's relevant to our Iditarod interests. Alaska, of course, is home to 2,000-mile sled dog races, and the Iditarod is just one of them. The other is the Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race, and there's actually quite a bit of overlap between the Quest and the Iditarod. Many mushers competed both races. Some even go back-to-back in the same year. This year's Yukon Quest started February 3rd, headed from Fairbanks to Whitehorse in Canada's Yukon Territory, hence the international in the name. Reporter Zoe Rome covered the race for Fairbanks radio station KUAC. We had her dispatches on Alaska Public Media. And I'm lucky enough to be talking to her from... where exactly are you?
I'm in Boulder, Colorado right now.
So can you give me kind of a recap of the race? I know that's tough. It's a long race. A lot happens. And we're a little removed from it here. But can you tell me kind of what happened in this year's Yukon Quest?
Yeah, so I think 13 mushers out of the original 26 made it. So it was just a really, really tough year in an already infamously challenging race. Basically, Alan Moore from day two had a really decisive lead. But even though Alan having a pretty decisive lead made things at the very front less exciting, there was so much drama in the middle and the back of the pack. And that's what gets you really excited, is watching these people really work through some stuff and push and form these relationships out on the trail.
It was pretty cold during this year's Quest, right?
It was so cold. I even got frostbite on my face and on my fingers. It was brutal. I had gone out onto the Yukon to, you know, really feel what it's like out there on the trail and to get some pictures of mushers, and you don't even realize it happens so fast. I mean, the coldest I ever was right around 50 below. But yeah, I heard it got as down as low as 60 below with wind chill out there. And that is pretty bitter.
We've talked about Alan Moore a little bit. And there's this piece of tape that I want to play that you got from him in Eagle right after he had pulled into the checkpoint.
Trail couldn't be any better. Whoa. Except for coming in here, a little bit of glare ice. That'll keep you awake. It'll keep those guys awake when they do it at night. It'll be interesting. But the trail's perfect.
One thing that strikes me about Alan is that he has one of the coolest voices that you'll ever hear in dog mushing.
Yeah, he's often referred to as the Southern Gentleman of mushing for that. And it does sound a little bit out of place in a dog sled race. When I first heard him speak, I was like, you're not from around here, are you? But I do think that his background, being from Arkansas, does kind of inform what he does and how he does it. I was asking him about his nickname, the Southern Gentleman of Mushing, and he said that one of the reasons he identifies with that is that when he's out there, particularly during the Iditarod, when he's a bit less competitive and he's just running his puppy team, he really takes a lot of pride in being able to stop and help younger and less experienced mushers or any musher that needs help. He takes that role really seriously and tries to be as helpful and accommodating as he can whenever he can be.
And so in the quest, he's running kind of the A-team for SP Kennels, and that's with his partner and wife, Allie Zirkel. She typically will take the A-team that he runs in the quest, or a lot of the dogs from it anyway, and then run it in the Iditarod. And this year in the quest, he finished the race with all 14 dogs that he started with. How big of a deal was that? How much were people talking about that at the finish of the quest?
Man, it was the talk of Whitehorse at the end of the race. Everyone was so impressed. The veterinarians, fans, other mushers, they looked great crossing the finish line. They were chipper and barking and digging into their steaks and just looking really happy.
There are also a lot of other mushers that run both races. Matt Hall is running the Iditarod this year. We also still have Hugh Neff, Catherine Keith, Rob Cook, Jason Campo still signed up. A handful of those actually pulled out of the quest. And I kind of wanted to talk a little bit more about those. Catherine Keith, it sounds like she broke her wrist kind of earlier in the race. What happened there?
Yeah, so apparently she was just sledding along and her sled bumped and threw her into a snowbank and she broke her wrist. Last I heard, she was still intending to run Iditarod. Like, that race means a lot to her, and she seemed really excited about it. I'm eager to see how that pans out for her, given that injury. That seems like something that would really make holding onto a sled hard work. And I mean, she doesn't just hold on. Like, she's always someone, when I saw her out on the trail, she's always pulling, and she's working hard herself. So, you know, we'll see. But she is, as of now, still signed up.
And then I think maybe Jason Campo was the next one to scratch from the quest. And you had some kind of like eyewitness experience with that.
Yeah, I saw him pass out next to his sled on the trail. You know, we started hollering at him, trying to see if he was okay. And he just kind of comes to and gets back on his sled and, you know, glides away. But just a couple, maybe a day or so later, he had to be evacuated in a military helicopter for a concussion that he had gotten after flipping his sled. I would be more surprised to see him in the Iditarod, just given the history of his injuries and given the fact that he had to be medically evacuated, you know, after being found just laying in the snow.
So kind of this other bummer thing that happened was that a dog in Hugh Neff's team died during the race. And he's a former champion. He'll tell you that for him, it's all about the dogs. Did he withdraw from the race because of that dog death?
He did. So what had happened is he had arrived in camp and he saw, you know, one of the rows of straw where some dogs had been bedded down by a previous musher. You know, there was already straw there. So he starts bedding his team down. It had been a long day. And apparently there had been some kibble in the straw. And his dog, Boppy, started just eating the kibble in the straw and began choking. You know, Neff tried to administer, like, mouth to nose and tried to do everything he could to save Boppy. And, you know, Boppy hung on for a little while after that, for about 9 or so hours. You know, it was just a lot for him. He was a younger dog, but he was a pretty key member of Neff's team. And that's just, you know, it's devastating to see. You know, there's no way Neff was going to stay in that race after what happened to Boppy. It's just not the ending that you want for anyone.
So we've been talking about the quest. I wonder, were quest mushers talking about the Iditarod and maybe the differences between the races? Did you get much insight on that?
Yeah. So since I was following the Yukon quest, a lot of those mushers, that's kind of their race. A lot of them have done both, but they're from the Fairbanks, Two Rivers area. That's kind of their it's their home turf. It's where they, you know, grew up or fell in love with mushing. And so there's a lot of emotional attachment to that. I know Alan Moore told me, I was asking him, I was like, honestly, which race do you prefer? I have to know. He said that the reason he preferred the Yukon Quest is because he's better at it. He said it's on a year where all like weather held equal, the Yukon Quest tends to be harder, but that the, you know, the crazy coastal weather that you get in the Iditarod can also just be prohibitively challenging.
Did any of these mushers that were in the quest sort of talk about the high profile of the Iditarod and how maybe that's different from the Yukon Quest?
Yeah, a lot of them talked about how important the Iditarod is for visibility and maintaining sponsorships. On one hand, all these people really want to do is get out and run with their dog team in the wilderness every single day. But they need to really work with partners and brands and sponsorships to be able to afford that because it's a really expensive sport. The Yukon Quest, I think, has done a great job of kind of maintaining its image as being this kind of rugged backcountry race that's, it's a family, it's small, it's not that corporate. But the Iditarod has a lot of cachet, not just in Alaska, but, you know, in the wider kind of sporting world. So a lot of these mushers see the Iditarod as their chance to really get their names and get their kennels' names out there and make a name for themselves and build sponsorships and make partnerships with brands that are going to be able to support them through the whole off season. Mushing is a full-time job. It takes a lot of work. And if you want to be rich and famous, you're probably not a musher.
You're not going to get rich doing this. Well, that seems like a good place to leave off. I really appreciate you joining me, Zoe. We enjoyed your coverage while you were out on the quest, and I hope you're catching up on some sleep now.
It's taking a while. My frostbite is pretty much healed, and I'm just about caught up on sleep.
So Zoe and I talked about the significance of Alan Moore winning the Yukon Quest and how his wife, Allie Zirkel, is his partner in that kennel, SP Kennel, out of Two Rivers, is going to be running kind of their A team in the Iditarod, as they've done for a number of years, making her probably fairly competitive, I would think, as usual in the Iditarod. Who else do you guys see kind of running at the front of the pack this year in the Iditarod?
You certainly can't discount Nick Petit, who came into that third place finish in Iditarod last year right behind Dallas Seavey and has had this really dominant early season performance this year already. Add that to his career building up. My eyes are very closely on Nick Petit.
Mitch Seavey, of course, I think is probably, it's safe to say, the favorite for many, having really done well the last few years, having a really strong kennel. Not having his main competitor, who for the last few years has been Dallas, his son. And of course, the last time this race was run on the Southern Route in 2013, it was won by Mitch. So certainly he's favored, I think, by many of us.
And has put together a system that just keeps getting better and better. And he's talked about how he's just going to plan on doing the same good things, just better. And you alluded to Dallas not being in the race, and we should mention he has pulled out in the midst of a dog doping scandal. We talked about that in the second episode, so if our listeners haven't heard that yet, you might want to go back and check it out.
I'll also, of course, be looking at Pete Kaiser. He's been really competitive the last few years, coming off a win at the K300, as we mentioned. Ben?
There's the Norwegian Jor Leifseth Olsen, who has almost never finished out of the top 10 in the few Iditarods that he's run. He hasn't run that many, but he's extremely close to the front, and he's kind of quiet on the trail, but you know he's lurking right there.
A rookie I think a lot of us are watching is Matt Hall. He is a rookie because he hasn't run the Iditarod before, but he has won the Yukon Quest. He won that last year and has been competitive in some other races as well, even taking top finishes.
And one of the bigger stories around the Iditarod this year is that we are back on the Southern Route. What is the significance of that?
The Southern Route goes through the namesake ghost town of Iditarod, through the gold rush country that sort of was the source of many of these trails at that time. We haven't done this since 2013. And I would say in 2013, we saw the experimental race style of Martin Boozer running almost 200 miles straight to Roan before declaring his 24-hour rest. That was a move that didn't turn out successful for him, but he experimented later and did have some really good races. So I would be very curious to see, now that we're back on the Alaska range, what that looks like.
I think for me, the big part of it is that there are a bunch of communities on that that southern route along the Yukon that have not been visited by the Iditarod since 2013, so about 5 years now. So that's Shagaluk, Anvik, Grayling, Eagle Island's in there, but that's not really a community. And I was talking to one of a principal at one of the schools who was really excited about it. She's a new principal, and she said she'd been asking her kids about it. And after a while, she just kind of said, you know, are you guys not excited about it? And they told her, we were kids when that last happened. She teaches high school. And that's really telling. I mean, you know, 5 years isn't a super long time, but for kids, for a small community like that, that can be a big amount of time. So I'm really excited to see a lot of that. Really excited to see Iditarod. I mean, this place that's so iconic for Alaska's history, that was a gold rush town, where there are still ruins and bank vaults and old, you know, brothel structures just kind of out there in what's now a ghost town. I think there were about 10,000 people that lived there at one point. So to get to pass through there, to get to go along that southern stretch of the Yukon, I think there's a lot of excitement there.
How much do we know about the trail itself? Part of this is it involves going back through some of the more challenging sections of the Iditarod Trail, the Dalzell Gorge. How much have you guys heard about what the trail is like this year?
There was a race update earlier today, and in it, one of the race officials from the Iditarod, Mark Nordman, who's in charge of trail conditions, gave a really excited update about it's really snowy out there. The trail looks great. There was a little bit of repair work in one section where a diversion in that area of the Dalzell Gorge was put in because it's been such a troubled spot the last few years. But that aside, I mean, everything is, there's a lot of snow, we've been told, really good conditions along most of the route. And that's kind of an exception in the last few years. It's sort of been a game of, are we going to have to move it? Is this section going to be okay? Where is there snow? Where isn't there snow? Reroutes, stuff like that. And this year, it's just kind of, it looks great, is what we've been told. The exception to that is along the coast, where really warm weather this year has meant really thin sea ice, and a February storm actually knocked a lot of it out in Norton Sound, the area from about Unalakleet up past Shaktulik and Koyuk all the way over through Elam and Golovin. So a lot of those routes that will usually hug the ice edge or the sea ice and cut diagonally in some areas are going to be hugging land, which will add a couple of miles and kind of alter the trail conditions. But that's really, we've been assured, a sort of minor issue that matters more for miles and not for safety.
The Dalzell Gorge in a low snow year, we should say, is not a minor issue. I covered the race in 2014, and I was talking to mushers in Nikolai at the checkpoint there, and there were some harrowing stories. Hugh Neff showed me his brake. It was just this, it's a piece of metal. It was broken in half. Robert Sorley from Norway, he's a firefighter at an airport there. He's probably seen some stuff in his day-to-day job. And he said that was the most scared that he had ever been coming through the Dalzell Gorge.
Broken legs, broken sleds, and broken dreams. And what really stood out to me was Aaron Burmeister took a nasty fall and broke his knee, or really, you know, kind of messed it up. And he finished the race, but by the time he got to Nome, and I mean, he was barely able to stand. And that happened in, you know, the first third of the race.
Seeing him in Nikolai, you're reminding me how he was hobbling around. He was describing it as a dislocated knee at the time. And I could not believe that he finished the race that year. And some of these horror stories kind of go into why they've made this decision to restart the race in Fairbanks. They didn't want to see that again. And so they're very happy to see that there's enough snow to actually go through that traditional southern route. So this is where I want to remind folks that we're again hoping to connect with our listeners by getting questions from them about the race and then hopefully answering them. Those can be in email form or even better as recorded voice memos. You can open up the voice memo app on your phone and record it and send us that question. If you've got one, we want you to send them to iditarod@alaskapublic.org, and we'll be able to include it here in the podcast. And it's kind of your chance to get on the podcast in your own voice. Today, we have our very first listener question. It comes to us from superfan Hannah in Boston.
Iditarod tourism, what is the scene? And more importantly, how can I be involved? Thanks.
Zach, you and I had sort of different interpretations of this question. I took it to be about maybe how to get involved with off-season tourism that a lot of mushers do to kind of sustain their business operations, to keep them going as competitive mushers in these races. So there are handler jobs that involves working at kennels that offer tours to summer tourists in Alaska, and they're kind of all over the state, wherever the mushers are sometimes, or they might be on a glacier, say near Skagway or Juneau. They advertise those on different message boards. One is sleddogcentral.com. You can also just Google dog mushing jobs or sled dog handler wanted and the different kennels that are looking for people. It'll pop up. But Zach, you had a different take on that. What was that?
Yeah, I heard Hannah from Boston's question, and I thought it meant tourism around the Iditarod, tourists that come to Alaska for the Iditarod, which, of course, we're gearing up for because on Saturday, the ceremonial start in downtown Anchorage is basically a giant event for tourists and townsfolk alike to come down and get to see some of the Iditarod. It's kind of a weird thing. They close off a bunch of the busiest streets in all of Alaska, and they're roped off, and there's just hordes of people trying to get a glimpse of their favorite mushers with just hundreds, like 12, 13, 1400 sled dogs in the streets of a major metropolitan area barking, and it's loud, and there's helicopters and planes overhead, and every couple of minutes once it starts, there are mushers taking off from this sort of pageant downtown and running on an 11-mile loop through the city of Anchorage. In recent years, there have been parties that are called tailgates, where people will sort of hang out along the paths, and it just feels like all across town, there's people that are sort of participating in different ways. So a lot of people come in for that. Many of them wear kind of eccentric, outlandish fur outfits, where you'll see a lot of lynx and bobcat and wolverine hats and, you know, ankle-length beaver fur coats and just all this kind of Alaskana out on display.
For most of the folks, though, to be able to see it in downtown Anchorage is kind of their only chance, and it does kind of contribute to that whole festival atmosphere.
Yeah, I feel like very divided about the ceremonial start because a lot of mushers really do not enjoy it. You have to like get there early, unload your dogs. They're very protective of their animals, and suddenly there's all these stressors and all these noises and people trying to pet them, and it's just a really hectic environment. And it's kind of crazy, and it's one of those times where it doesn't seem like it's in the interests of the mushers or the animals so much as the event, but I do think it is kind of one of the ways that this crazy thing is still made accessible to people here and gives people an opportunity to come for this really unique event. I like to say it's one part pageant, one part parade to really kick off the Iditarod.
Well, we covered a lot of ground here today. Thanks to Ben Matheson, Zoe Rome, and Zachariah Hughes for being on the podcast. Keep an eye out for our next episode. It'll be coming this weekend. If you're not already, you can subscribe to the Iditapod at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen online at alaskapublic.org. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm Casey Grove. Catch you next time, and until then, happy trails.
If you're a parent or a sibling worried that we won't play it because of nepotism or because we played you last year, don't worry. We don't believe in that. Parents and siblings go to the top of the list.
They go to the top of the list because then you get to hear their voice while you're out on the trail, maybe.
Yeah, you're just alone and you want your sweet papa's voice coming through your pod.
Sweet papa, mama, wondering if you're getting enough sleep or enough to eat. What was the best question you guys ever got from a family member?
We each only got one.
Oh.
So that one.
should we talk about Snack Attack with Ben and Zach? Or no?
Snack Attack with Zach and Davis.
It doesn't have the same ring to it.
No, we should talk about that later, but I think we've covered enough ground here.
Okay, and Ben needs to go back to work. So
this is exactly what I told you I wasn't going to do this year.
Because we already referred to you not getting paid for this in the last
every joke
first episode.
That we make here is another minute of Ben's lunch break.
You can tell that it's killing him. Okay, shall I wrap it up?
No.
Yes, please. Wrap it up.